Welcome to today's program titled Employee Social Networking, Protecting Your Trade Secrets in Social Media. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question, and hit the send message button. In the conference materials pod on the handout tab, you will find materials for today's session. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the log information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Justin Beyer, Joshua Salinas, and Scott Schaffers. You may begin.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you're at. Welcome to Seyfarth Shaw LLP's second installment of its 2014 Trade Secrets webinar series. We're happy to have you. This installment, this webinar, is entitled Employee Social Networking, Protecting Your Trade Secrets in Social Media. My name is Scott Schaffers. I'm a partner in Seyfarth's Chicago Litigation Department. I emphasize my work in trade secrets, computer fraud, and non-competes practice group, and also Seyfarth's Social Media Privacy Practice Group. Also with me today is my partner, Justin Beyer. He's also a member of Seyfarth's Trade Secrets Practice Group. Also with us on the line is Joshua Salinas, an attorney in our Los Angeles Century City office. And his work largely involves cases in our Trade Secrets Group. And again, thank you for joining us today. Here is a high-level summary of what we will cover. First, I, Scott Schaffers, will talk about the social media privacy statutes, which are in effect in 14 states across the country, as well as what they say, what they prohibit, what they permit, some of the remedies and consequences, as well as some of the gaps that need to be filled by the courts. After I finish, Justin will take over and we'll talk about Josh will take over and we'll talk about these new privacy statutes' impact on employers' trade secrets and proprietary assets. For example, what will reasonable efforts under the circumstances mean in trade secrets litigation are among the topics Josh will cover. Finally, Justin will talk about employers implementing social media policies. And he will touch on a number of things which employers should consider in light of the new legislation. So first off, I always like to tell the audience, why do you care about what we're talking about? Well, as you know, everybody and their brother and their sister and their mother has some form of social networking account. Over 1 billion Facebook users, 300 million LinkedIn, 650 million Twitter, and so on. It's here to stay. It has been here to stay for a number of years. Why else should you care what we're talking about? Well, as I said before, the legislation between 2012 and up till 2 weeks ago has spread like wildfire. 14 states have passed these laws in less than 2 years. Nearly every other state in the union, as well as Congress, has hoppered some form of privacy legislation, meaning that they've introduced it, considered it. Some of them died in committee. Some of them died shortly thereafter. But they are certainly still on the radar screens of most, if not all, the assembly houses across the country. Another reason that's not stated on the slide, why do you care? Let's say that you work for a company and the company has on its application form a line for the employee to fill out, or applicant rather, to fill out, asking, do you have a social networking account? If so, please provide your handle, your login, and your password. If you got that on your application, you will probably want to hear what we have to say. Or let's say that your HR department has a script of sorts for interviewing job applicants. One of the questions you ask is the same as what I just referred to. Do you have an account? If so, let us see it. Or you're thinking about implementing a policy for existing employees. What's your social networking account handle, username, login, and let us see it. Or why don't you add us to your profile? Something like that. If any of those are true, or anything that is similar to any of those scenarios is true for you and your company, I would encourage you to pay attention to what we have to say. So, soon to be published. Before we get going, soon to be published, this is the cover page of our survey of employer social media legislation. We've been working on it carefully for the last several months. It's going to be a 15, 20, 25 page handbook that you can keep on your desk. It will list each and every state that has a social media privacy statute. It will describe the various features of those statutes, and it will also contain some pretty in-depth material about what to expect, not only from litigation under these statutes, but how it might affect other types of litigation, trade secrets litigation, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act litigation, discovery in any type of litigation. Will employers be able to discover social media profiles in light of this new era of privacy legislation? This should be published, as I indicated, within the next month or so. Anybody who wants a copy, we will happily send it to you with our compliments, and we hope that you will find it useful. So, here's a list. 14 states currently have one form or another of social media privacy legislation on the books, signed by the governors. On April 8th, Governor Walker signed the Wisconsin Social Media Privacy Statute. That's the last one on your list. Vermont, we included it because last year, I believe it was April, May, maybe June, they passed a law which commissioned enacted a Blue Ribbon Commission study of social media legislation. The commission was to talk about whether they should do it, how does it interact with federal statutory framework for social media privacy, whether it's a good idea, and what type of legislation should be enacted, if any. The committee came out with a report January 14th, 2014, said we met, we talked, we couldn't reach an agreement, so we're nowhere. As far as we know, that the legislation or the idea of it even has not been revisited in Vermont. In any event, each and every one of these states is covered in our soon-to-be-published desktop reference, and each state's features are described in the reference that we are soon to send out. So, first part, I'm going to get into some of the features of the legislation. First, what's prohibited and what are the teeth so to speak? What are the possible penalties for the employer or the remedies for an aggrieved employee? First, in simple terms, an employer cannot ask or cannot insist on the employee providing employer access to his or her social networking account. Access is defined as turning over your login information. Scott.Shapers at gmail.com for Facebook, and what's my password? An employer cannot ask that under normal circumstances. We'll get into some of the exceptions in the next slide. Also, the access that is prohibited is requiring or even asking employees to add an HR rep to your account, to your social networking profile. You can't even ask or require that an employee open his or her LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, in front of a designated company rep. A lot of these forms of access are kind of lumped together under the term, quote, shoulder surfing. So the employers must be wary of requesting or requiring any type of access to a social media account. I will go through the exceptions and the contours of those prohibitions, but that's generally what's prohibited. Second, not surprisingly, not only can you not require or ask for access, you can't retaliate against an employee or a job applicant if they refuse to provide you the access, if they invoke their rights under this new legislation. Some of the statutes also say that you cannot retaliate against another employee or that same employee for filing a complaint or participating in the hearing, providing testimony, or just giving an interview to the investigator. What are the consequences? What do employers face if they violate the statute? Well, those are different from state to state. Many of the states, the remedies and consequences for one violation or a couple violations are not that heavy. States like New Jersey, all the employee can do is file a complaint with the DOL, the state DOL, which then may investigate and impose nominal penalties. And some states, one of the states, I can figure out which one, says that any penalties are paid over to the state and not even the employee. Those are the light states. And if you were to put the states on a scale between light and heavy states, the light states would certainly outweigh the heavy states. States with heavy penalties, for example, Oregon, an employee who is aggrieved or who is the victim of a violation of the statute, they can file a lawsuit. They can get a minimum $200 penalty, compensatory damages. There's some provisions say punitive damages. Attorney's fees is the big kicker in a lot of these employment-related cases. And then equitable remedies, reinstatement, back pay, etc. I will note that, for example, in some states, it's tricky to figure out whether there is, in fact, any remedial scheme. For example, in Nevada, the social media statute is made part of its workplace-related statutory remedies framework, but it's very unclear what the remedies are. It's not as if there's a reference in the remedies section of that statute, which incorporates the social media statute. So, we will say that it is unclear in some states what the penalties are, but some states like Oregon, like New Jersey, make it very clear. Now, we've talked about what's prohibited. We should talk about what's permitted. Most of these statutes are chock full of loopholes and exemptions and escape clauses. One of the bigger ones is that some statutes only prohibit mandatory or even requested access to a purely personal account. What is a personal account? Well, some of the statutes say that an account opened at the employer's request, or an account opened on an employer device, or which is at all used for employer business, is not a personal account and is therefore fair game to the employer. There haven't been any court cases addressing what constitutes a personal account. And in our view, the statutes and the legislatures would do well to further define it in some circumstances. But if it's a non-personal account for which the employee at least substantially uses it to further employer business, then a strong argument can be made that that account is fair game. What's another loophole? What's another exception to the prohibitions in the statute? Suspected workplace-related misconduct. Let's say the employer has information that an employee downloaded an employer customer list to his or her LinkedIn account. If the employer has a reasonable belief that that happened, then the employer can demand that the employee provide access to that account. Or, for example, there's information that a coworker engaged in some form of harassment against an employee under a protected class via a social networking account, then yes, the employer can demand access. Also, the statutes do not, by and large, they do not prohibit employers from normal monitoring of their devices and their systems. They can review the activity of employees on their employer-owned devices, or in some instances, devices which an employee owns but uses for employer business. So let's say an employer comes across a Facebook screen in its normal monitoring activity. There's nothing wrong with that, so long as they did not request or demand access to the account and the activity was conducted on an employer-owned device. Companies in a regulated industry, a self-regulated industry like FINRA, which is right across the street from our Chicago office, those companies which have a duty to pre-screen employees, for example, brokers, salespersons, they can demand access to personal social media accounts to make sure that the employee fits the bill. Compliance with otherwise valid state and federal laws, those are largely undefined by the statutes. But for example, let's say the employer gets a subpoena for certain material. Well, the employer will have a strong argument under this state and federal compliance exception to say that, hey, I need access to your account to comply with the subpoena. Lastly, most of the statutes do contain a proviso which says that employers are free to look for, search for, and use in their employment decisions information which is in the public space of a social networking account. Let's say that you have very liberal access settings in your Facebook or LinkedIn account where non-friends, non-contacts can see a lot of your photos, a lot of your wall postings, so on and so forth. If those are available to the employer without demanding access or without requesting access, then that is fair game as well. So the point here is this, is that even though these statutes were passed and even though there was a fair amount of pomp and circumstance by the governors, by the legislative sponsors of these laws, that, hey, we need to protect employee privacy and their social media accounts, the statutes are written in such a way that employers can get around them without a hell of a lot of effort. So I'll wrap up by saying here are some of the gaps that the courts will have to address, as I alluded to before. What is a personal versus an employer account? Some statutes try to define them, some don't. If an employee is asked by the employer to open a LinkedIn account so he or she can raise the profile of the company or go out and develop business or credential themselves, then many of the statutes would say that those accounts are fair game. Now, let's say that the employer does not ask the employee or employees to open or use their LinkedIn accounts, but the employees do so anyway because they're investing in themselves and their careers. Their strong arguments can be made under the statutes that even though it was entirely the employee's idea to use their account in that way to promote themselves and their employer, then the employer can ask for access to that. Another interesting thing to consider, which is not made clear by the statutes, bring your own device environments. What about companies which say, hey, you employees bring your own devices to work, use your own laptops, use your own iPhones, PDAs, in our office. Well, the employee owns those, right? But they're being used for company business. So that's another thing that the courts will have to weigh in on and that the statutes don't make clear. Another aspect, which Josh will go into more detail on shortly, is what about an employer's trade secrets? Pricing information, profit and loss reports, customer databases, customer files, secret formulas, so on and so forth. What happens if an employee takes it, puts it on his social network account, a customer list or what have you? The employer has reason to believe that he did so, but for some reason opts not to investigate it. Does that leakage of the trade secret now constitute an unreasonable effort to protect, thus constituting a waiver of trade secret protection for that asset? That's something we have to consider. Also, now that there is an added layer of employee social privacy and social networking accounts, do judges in litigation, let's say, Title VII litigation, do they now have to give a bit more deference to those privacy statutes and say, I'm not going to order discovery of that account content in light of New Jersey's or Illinois' or Michigan's new privacy statute? That's something else the judges will have to consider. Finally, as Justin will talk about shortly, what about companies for which a lot of you on the call work for have offices in different states? For example, a New York-based company that has a New Jersey office. Jersey has an employee privacy statute. New York does not. Which state's law is going to govern? Things like that are all things which the courts are likely to address. I will say, based on our searches done as recent as yesterday, there do not appear to be any reported decisions, state, federal cases, which have decided any disputes under the new social media privacy statutes since the laws have been enacted. But they are sure, and there's an explanation for that, because the case has to go through the hearing process and or trial process, be taken up on appeal, briefed, and the appeal decided before it's reported. But a lot of these issues will have to be addressed by the courts because of the statutes, because of the gaps in the statutes. So now I will turn it over to Josh Salinas in our Los Angeles office. He is going to talk about some of the implications for trade secrets brought on by these new statutes. Josh?
Thanks, Scott. So we're seeing that the social media has become pretty much pervasive and ubiquitous, not only in everybody's everyday lives, but also in the workplace. And as these stats show, that there's just increasing rise of people signing on and using social media. So with social media in the business world, it increases to rise. There has been some legislation adopted recently, which we've discussed on our blog. The White House Obama administration has issued its five-point plan to combat trade secret theft. There's been some recent legislation to expand penalties, and we're seeing that not only is there increased attempts at theft of trade secrets within the U.S., but also from foreign entities, from foreign state actors, from foreign governments. Now, with trade secrets and social media creates this inherent risk to protecting trade secrets. The fundamental premise of social media is you're sharing information, you're circulating, distributing information within your social network, within your community. And with trade secrets, the goal is really to preserve the secrecy of that information. And with all this new social media, new technology, it's influencing the way courts are looking at information that may have been defined as a trade secret before and may no longer have that same protection anymore. But first, going to a brief background of what trade secrets actually are. It has to be information. It doesn't have to be written or published, but it has to be some type of information that is secret. It's not known to others. It has some value, and the trade secret holder has made some reasonable efforts to maintain that secrecy. Many of us are familiar with, you know, the secret recipe or formula for Coca-Cola, or for the secret herbs and spices for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and also other products such as WD-40. And these are recognized as trade secrets, but also some things that are also protected include, you know, a company's business and marketing plans. With customer lists, depending on the jurisdiction, some states will recognize that customer lists actually need to have more than just be a mere list of names and addresses, but has some additional information about the customers, such as their preferences, maybe financial information, or their interests, something that your company has invested, expended time and resources gathering more than just a simple name or address that could be found publicly online. One thing that sometimes is overlooked is actually information regarding negative know-how. So if a company has expended resources, expending time, and discovered or learned that a certain method or a certain practice or technology does not work, that information, that negative know-how, could be protectable as a trade secret. Now, with courts seeing new cases with social media and seeing whether information online, whether social media information could be a trade secret, they're using the six factors, which are from the Restatement of Torts, and it looks at whether information is protectable as a trade secret. And the courts are looking at, one, the extent known outside the company, the extent that's known within the company, and what are the measures taken by that company to protect the secrecy of the information, the value to not only the company but also the competitors, all the resources, time, and effort that's gone to developing that information. And also, which is probably one of the key things that courts are looking at specifically with social media cases, is how easy is it for the public or competitors to access this information. And we'll see this as we discuss the Sasquatch Group versus Courtney case, that some information that may have been considered a trade secret is now accessible online with Google, with LinkedIn, with all these new search engines, may not have that secret status anymore. Now, protecting trade secrets, there has to be reasonable efforts made to keep that information secret. There was a recent case that came out of, I believe, the Northern District of California involving software trade secrets. And the plaintiff in that case had given the defendant trade secrets, had warned him about not disclosing it, employed non-confidentiality agreements, had security protocols, had password-protected devices. But the defendant in that case said that the trade secret holder didn't do everything necessary. Specifically, the defendant said that if anybody who had $1 billion, they could reverse engineer this trade secret. And so they said, anything with enough time and money could be reverse engineered and, wouldn't be a trade secret. And of course, the court was not convinced and, really emphasized your secrecy efforts have to be reasonable. They don't have to be absolute. And so we're seeing with social media, new technologies, that what actually is reasonable may be changing and likely is. And so why are we concerned with social media for trade secrets? Well, we're looking at actually who is taking this information. There's a recent study that came out, I think, last year by Symantec, and they looked at the psychology behind why employees think it's okay to steal and take information. But we're seeing that 90% of the time, misappropriation is done by these rogue employees, by business partners, and a lot of it's done by electronic means. And the reason we're seeing it with so many, you know, employees and business partners is, you know, simple numbers. They're the ones who have the most access to this information. It's easy to access information. They have, you know, the passwords. And also with technology, with, you know, flash drives that can take an entire computer's worth of information, with, you know, high-speed mobile devices, it's sometimes too easy to simply copy and take this information. And so that's why we're seeing a rise, and also with social media, as people are, you know, being connected, being logged on in their workplace. And so one of the early cases that showed the risks of losing trade secret status with new social media was this case out of the Eastern District of New York, Sasqua Group versus Courtney. It involved the employer, who was an executive search consulting firm, and they had an employee who, when she left from the company, purportedly took a client database, a client information. And so once she purportedly was soliciting former clients, the company then sued. And during one of the hearings, the employee actually showed the court, you know, how easy it was to get this information. The employer said, you know, this was protectable as a trade secret. In that case, there was no restrictive covenants, no non-competes, no non-solicits. So it was difficult. It ultimately came down to a trade secret case. But the employee said, you know, look, all this information's online. She logged onto Google, LinkedIn, and was able to find all this information for the court. And so the court said, you know, looking at the six factors, how easy it is to access this information, you know, this is likely not a trade secret. And so the court found that this database of information was not a trade secret, but it had a really interesting quote. It said at the end that, you know, when this company first started, its measures to protect its trade secrets may have been sufficient, but now with you know, the intense search capabilities of Google, with all this social media, with LinkedIn, all this stuff online, you know, those traditional methods of secrecy may no longer be sufficient in light of these new technologies. And so another case that was closely followed involved Twitter. It was called PhoneDog versus Kravitz. PhoneDog was a mobile device, a technology, a wireless news and review company, and they had an employee, Noah Kravitz, manage the a Twitter account. And he, I think, developed and created about 17,000 followers. As you can see on the slide, the name was PhoneDog Noah. When the employee departed from the company, he changed the handle to his name, Noah Kravitz, and then began working for a competitor, and also had, you know, access to those 17,000 followers now. And so the employer brought action on grounds of, in part, trade secret most appropriation, saying, you know, the theft of that password of the account and all the subscribers was trade secret theft, and the employee had failed to return it. The case initially survived the preliminary motion stages, and so the court, it didn't actually decide whether the information was in fact a trade secret, but said, you know, this information, it couldn't be, but that's more appropriate for a summary judgment. So that we were looking forward to getting, you know, some resolution on that case, but the case ultimately settled, and the employee, as part of the settlement, kept that Twitter account. And last, this is a case that's currently pending in the Colorado District Court. It involves dance club owner partners. One of them had developed thousands of contacts through MySpace, and the business partner allegedly stole the MySpace login info and, you know, allegedly stole that contact list. And so the issue was whether, you know, those friends, those networks, those contacts could be a trade secret. And the interesting thing about this case was the court found that, you know, the friends could be protectable, but it was actually that relationship. It was that contact, that networking, not merely the public list. And so the court was recognizing that the trade secret holder had contacted each of these individuals online, had gotten their permission to accept that request, had gotten their contact information, and had that permission to keep in contact with them. And the court recognized that, you know, anybody else could technically do that over time, but there's no guarantee actually those individuals are going to accept that request and grant that permission. So this case recognizes that you could have a trade secret in a friend's relationship, a customer list, but it's not merely that public list, it's more that ancillary information. And so we're seeing just a summary. Do customer lists constitute trade secrets on social media? With the Sasswell Group versus Courtney, mere addresses and contact information that could be found online, likely no, but possibly if there's additional information, as we've seen with PhoneDog and the Christow and Bport case. Now, one interesting issue that we're seeing that hasn't been too well developed are the ownership issues with social media. With the PhoneDog case, as previously discussed, the employee was able to keep the password to that account, leave, change the handle, and ultimately ended up keeping the account as part of the settlement. In that case, there was no agreement of ownership. There was no return of that password provisions, and so it shows that even if the company brings litigation, during the entirety of that litigation, the employee could still retain access to that account. Eagle versus Morgan is another closely followed case regarding LinkedIn. In that case, the CEO, when she had created a LinkedIn profile, got about 4,000 followers, 4,000 connections, and when she left the company who had a policy that employees should create these accounts, should foster, develop these accounts, and even had employees managing other employees managing that account. When the employee left, the employer was able to log in with the password, change it, and put somebody else in the place. And so the court ultimately held that even though the employer had a policy that encouraged social media accounts created for the company, there were no clear ownership policies, and there was no clear defined definition of who owned the account, who controlled the account, and who should get the account upon the employee's departure. In that case, the court awarded the account to the employee, but the employee who had a counterclaim for some invasion of privacy claims found that there was ultimately no damage. So, finally, probably the best illustration of best practices is Artis Health versus Nankerville. In that case, an employee was hired to manage the company's social media account. And in that case, the employer had a clear agreement that information would be returned, confidential information, upon the employee's departure. And so it wasn't a clear ownership agreement that the social media should all be returned. But it is a good example that when you have somebody who's going to be managing your social media account, you need to describe that relationship, define the ownership of that arrangement, and have a provision that that password and that account will be returned. In that case, the court ultimately ordered the return of the account because it found it was clear that the social media account belonged to the employer. It's a good recommendation for employers to have a clear, separate ownership agreement for social media accounts. As Scott previously mentioned, there's that fine line of when is something personal and when is something a non-personal or a business social media account. So early on, it's recommended to have these ownership policies that describe who actually owns the account, what the employer is going to be doing. Trying to encompass a return of property account sometimes gets tricky because sometimes passwords or social media accounts may not fall into the traditional definitions of what property is, and so usually you want to include something that defines the return of those passwords. You can also incorporate that into your non-disclosure confidentiality agreements. And so looking into, lastly, before I turn it over to Justin, restrictive covenants are commonly used to protect trade secrets, protect confidential information, non-compete agreements, non-solicitation of customers, non-solicitation of employees. We're seeing a trend with courts to kind of find in favor of the employees that mere passive activity on social media, posting something to your LinkedIn account, updating your profile, may not violate your non-solicitation or non-compete provisions of agreements. In Enhanced Network Solutions, they found just publicly posting LinkedIn job postings didn't necessarily violate a solicitation agreement. In NVIDIA, engaging with Facebook friends didn't necessarily violate a non-solicitation of customers provision. And the key facts in all these cases were that the activities were not direct targeted solicitations to the individual, either customer or employee. These were generally broad announcements or passive postings. The courts in these cases have acknowledged that, you know, solicitation on social media could be a violation of a restrictive covenant agreement, but in all these cases, they weren't akin to the traditional direct solicitations we've seen, such as calling somebody up on the phone or sending an email. So we just haven't seen these cases yet, but it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody could be liable for violating a non-compete or a non-solicit based on their social media activity. And so we're seeing that, you know, it's recommended to have restrictions, to have agreements, to have policies in place to protect your trade secrets, especially to regulate employees' social media activity. But being too aggressive or having too overly broad provisions may invoke the ire of the National Labor Relations Board, which Justin is going to go further into.
Thanks, Josh. Before we move into some of the best practices that we want to, that we think is appropriate in creating social media policies, at this time we're going to read off the attendance code for your CLE credit. This is going to be read, once. I will repeat the code a second time, but after that we will not read it again. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you early next week. The code is SS0234. Again, the code is SS0234. So the main thing that's coming out based on these social media legislation that's coming out, as well as an increased effort by the NLRB to regulate employers in their social media policies, is that there are certain things that employers need to take into consideration when creating those social media policies. We're going to cover three of those in a little more depth today. The first of which is how the NLRB is, and the National Labor Relations Board is interpreting these various social media and online usage policies vis-a-vis the National Labor Relations Act. The second thing that we're going to talk about this afternoon in relation to the social media policies is how multi-state employers, in other words, an employer who, let's say, is headquartered in New York but employs people in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, elsewhere around the country, how those employers need to craft their social media policies, particularly where these various states have differing standards or no standards at all as it relates to usage of social media in that particular state. The final thing that is really important for employers to take into consideration is really trying to predict what is going to take place in the future as it relates to social media and social media policies. A lot of the questions that are arising out of this legislation, the NLRB decisions, and social media policies around the country are unanswered at this point in time. And we're going to offer some of our suggestions as it relates to the best practices. So the primary place that an employer really should start is having a better understanding of the National Labor Relations Act and how the NLRB is treating social media policies. Within the last 4 years, the NLRB has taken the stance that social media policies fall under the umbrella of the NLRA. Effectively, the NLRA is a federal law that's designed to protect employees' rights to organize unions, to conduct labor strikes, or to engage in collective bargaining. There's no specific provision preventing employers from stifling speech. There are provisions in the NLRA that are intended to prevent employers from stifling speech that can be interpreted as falling under any of these categories. And starting in 2010, the NLRB started to consider a number of these particular cases relating to employer social media policies. In all, they've issued three reports since 2010, one in 2011 and two in 2012. Frankly, at a high level, the NLRB is determining what workplace social media policies cannot prohibit activity protected by federal law. They're finding that companies may not punish or terminate an employee for authoring public posts about the company or their workplace so long as those comments can be construed as a discussion with fellow employees and a potential first step towards self-organizing. As you can imagine, this is a very small hurdle over which employees must step to make the argument that a policy is overly broad. But employees' comments are not protected if the comments are deemed to be quote-unquote mere gripes that are not made in relation to group activity amongst other employees. In the three reports that I mentioned just a moment ago, the NLRB discussed various types of social media policies and cases that it was seeing and summarized the results of those cases. To summarize, the NLRB examined 20 different company policies and found that 16 of those 20 policies were overly broad. About half of those cases addressed employee use of Facebook and Twitter and found that the employees were engaged in protected activity. In the last report that the NLRB issued in May of 2012, the NLRB stressed that employers need to carefully craft their online usage social media policies to avoid overly broad language that an employee could reasonably construe to prohibit protected activity. In that same report, the NLRB warned that disclaimer language, in other words, language where the employer said this policy is not intended to restrict, protected speech under the NLRA or something to that effect, was insufficient to cure a defective policy. Just yesterday, in fact, the NLRB ruled that an online communications policy of Kroger Company, a supermarket chain, was unlawfully overbroad. In that decision, the ALJ found that four provisions in Kroger's policy violated the NLRA. Those provisions were a provision that required workers to use a specific disclaimer if they identified themselves as a company associate and, quote, publish any work-related information online, close quote. Barred the use without permission, the use of Kroger's insignia, banner, or logo. Three, restricted discussion of confidential and proprietary information. And four, prohibited inappropriate online behavior. In one particularly telling comment in the opinion, the ALJ wrote that, quote, the requirement that a disclaimer be posted by the employee every time he or she speaks on work-related issues and is identifiable as an employee of the employer is unduly burdensome, well beyond any legitimate interest of the employer, and will have a tendency to chill legitimate speech, Section 7 speech, by the burden it brings to it. So the real question is, what is acceptable? The NLRB has nixed a surprisingly long list of standard policy language that we see that our clients intend to use. Some of the policy language that the NLRB has held to be unlawful includes confidentiality provisions that warn employees about sharing confidential information without identifying categories of non-NLRA protected confidential information. For example, in the Kroger decision, the ALJ found that a sentence in Kroger's policy prohibiting comments on rumors or speculation related to the company's business plans would reasonably be understood by an employee to cover a range of issues such as layoffs and closures, topics about which employees have a right to speak. Another policy provision the NLRB has determined to be unlawful are provisions warning employees about their online posts being completely accurate and not misleading. In that particular decision, the NLRB determined that this provision was overly broad because, quote, it could reasonably be interpreted to apply to discussions about or criticism of that employer's labor policies and its treatment of employees that would be protected by the act so long as they are not maliciously false, close quote. Trying to draft a policy under those particular circumstances where an employer cannot restrict an employee from posting things that are completely accurate and not misleading is a difficult standard for which to overcome. Another provision that the NLRB has found unlawful required employees to communicate in a professional tone without making objectionable or inflammatory comments. Another provision that was found unlawful was one restricting employee contact with the media. And a fifth one as just an example, is a provision threatening employees with discharge or criminal prosecution for failing to report unauthorized access to or misuse of confidential information. As you can see, crafting a policy which the NLRB will find appropriate and lawful can be difficult. One growing trend we do see, however, and this is something that Scott touched on briefly, is that public posts on a Facebook page that an employer can access without requiring or requesting access from another employee or from the employee who owns the Facebook or Twitter account is lawful. And we've seen that just this past September in the Ayling decision, Judge Martini in the District of New Jersey ruled that while a Facebook post in a private setting can be is protected under the Stored Communications Act, the employer did not violate the Stored Communications Act by receiving copies of those posts from a friend of that particular individual who happened to be a coworker. Additionally, in an earlier decision, the Northern District of Illinois granted summary judgment to the employer where it found that the employee's posts were public and the employee had no expectation of privacy in those posts. Beyond the NLRB's treatment of social media policies, multi-state employers also need to take care in crafting their policies. As Scott mentioned, a large number of states have either adopted or are considering social media privacy legislation. An issue that we're seeing is that multi-state employers either are in states that have no policy, are in a state that doesn't define what a personal account is, or have employees in states that which fall under either of these categories. Probably the easiest way to deal with this is to include a choice of law and venue provision in any policy. A fairly recent United States Supreme Court decision, Atlantic Marine, found that choice of law provisions are enforceable except in exceptional circumstances. And while the court there hasn't defined what quote-unquote exceptional circumstances are in this type of context, these type of choice of law provisions should generally be enforceable. But in the case that they're not, however, employers need to be careful to not overstep the bounds of the state in which the employee sits. Because if no choice of law applies, then the state in which litigation is taking place is going to conduct a choice of law analysis, and in many times they're going to give strong deference to the state in which the alleged activity took place. So in this particular case, if you're talking about someone who has posted inflammatory comments on their Facebook page, it's going to generally, the law is going to be utilized where the employee made that comment. So crafting social media policies. At a high level, employers need to take into consideration what the NLRB is saying, and they need to make sure that their policies articulate clear business interests for any restrictions, and particularly when defining what confidential information cannot be posted, they need to provide examples of non-NLRB protected language that would be prohibited from being posted. Employers also need to take state law concerns into account. If an employer sits in a state which social media legislation has been enacted that defines personal account, that law should be selected. If not, probably should still select the state in which the employer sits or has its headquarters, simply because HR then only needs to know one type of law. And as we'll discuss in just a moment, there are workarounds. You can always include in your social media policy a definition of what a quote-unquote personal account is. Then you also need to take into consideration job-specific accounts, particularly those where the employer either provided the access or required the account. As Josh discussed, we've certainly seen cases where ownership of accounts and followers is litigated. And to solve this problem, we recommend social media policies which clearly delineate who owns the account, how login and password information is to be established, and to require employees to confirm the login and password credentials upon termination. Moreover, that sort of agreement should specify that accounts are only to be used for business purposes. That way you can obviate some of the issues that would arise where there is a question as to whether it's a personal account or a business account. And finally, if the employee is specifically tasked with maintaining that account, a job description should be prepared and disseminated to that employee or the employees who are going to be managing the account. Some additional considerations. As I mentioned just a moment ago, if the business resides in a state where a personal account is not defined, the employer should consider defining what constitutes a personal account in the policy and what constitutes a business account. You also need to consider and address the permissible scope of employer investigations involving mandatory access to employee accounts. That may not fall under your policy, so to speak, but that should be something that is at least discussed and have a written guideline for your HR personnel who would be conducting these types of investigations. You need to consider the implications of trade secrets with the mandatory access provisions and how that may impact your efforts to reasonably protect that information. You should consider how access to social media accounts content will be handled if litigation arises between yourself and the employee. There may be a provision in there to discuss that. You need to consider the interplay between your online policy with the NLRB cases, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Economic Espionage Act, and the Stored Communications Act. And finally, you should deal with conflict of law analysis, particularly for interstate or telecommuting employees. So some takeaways that we'd like you to glean from today's presentation. Really need to determine whether the company has employees in states with or planning to adopt social media privacy laws. That's going to impact the way that you define your social media and how you want to craft your policy. When reviewing your policies, you need to determine if ownership and access rights of company-sponsored accounts is adequately determined. For example, as we talked about in the PhoneDog case, if PhoneDog had something defining that they were the owner of the account and any of the people who liked or followed the account, much of the issues that arose in Kravitz might have been avoided. You might want to consider blocking access to social networking sites for non-business uses at work. That's not going to obviously take care of an employee who goes home and writes about the company, but at a minimum, it's going to protect the employer from the employee doing it on company time. 4, when conducting your investigations of employee social media use, you need to make sure that employees involved in the investigation know what they may request and what they may not. That's something that Scott covered earlier. 5, as we recommend with confidentiality policies, we recommend conducting annual training on the company's social media policy. And where you're updating that policy, consider ways in which you can have employees update their agreement to it. It could be online confirmation. It could be much like many companies do with their handbook dissemination. 6, don't overlook that social media evidence when conducting an employee investigation. As Scott discussed, if there's a belief that an employee has improperly used social media to harass someone or to take trade secrets, there are exceptions both under the NLRB guidelines as well as the state litigation that allow companies to access that. 7, you really need to make sure that your policies are narrowly tailored and that you define what is prohibited activity. The main thing that the NLRB seems to be saying is that where employees can reasonably expect or can reasonably interpret a policy to prohibit protected speech, that is the instances in which the NLRB is finding that the policies are overly broad. And finally, as Scott was discussing earlier, also you should really consider your bring-your-own-device policy. There are benefits to the devices being company-owned that you can reasonably access those posts and whatnot if it's from a company device. So we wanted to thank you for your participation today. You can continue to follow our blog postings as well as other interesting topics that we're going to cover through our Trade Secrets blog, which can be followed at www.tradesecretslaw.com. We're also on social media ourselves. You can follow us at Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Tumblr, YouTube, and we were named to the Law Blog Top 100 for 2013, so we may be worth your follow. We do have a couple questions, and I'm going to pass it back over to Scott, who is going to address those questions.
Quickly. I know we're out of time, but first question, can an employer ask that employee, quote, like the employer's page on Facebook? Very good question. I don't know the technical answer to that, but my observation is that if that liking the employer's profile on Facebook means that the employer has access to the employee's full site, to which is not otherwise public, then technically, no. An employer in a social media privacy state cannot ask the employee to like it. The concern would be that the employer is using the like request as a pretext for mandatory or requested access to the employee's account. I'm happy to follow up on that after looking at my Facebook profile and determining whether merely liking a page gives the host of that page access to your account. That's something I'm very curious about. Second question, can you explain a little bit more about self-regulatory duties and the permitted access to an employee's account under that exception? I took a look while the others were presenting at, for example, the Michigan social media privacy statute, which has an exception for self-regulatory screening compliance. That exception is really applicable to national stock exchanges, NYSE, CME, you name it, as well as brokerage houses, trading brokerage houses. For example, if a broker or a trader, normally they have to disclose any prior blips in their licensure or any issues they had with NASD or FINRA or some other regulatory company. If you're a brokerage house, if you're the stock exchange, it's likely permissible for you to ask for or even demand access to an employee's social networking account. Again, this is not legal advice. Every situation depends on where you're at, your specific circumstances, and so on and so forth. But that's the answer to the question that we were able to find in this limited time. So that's all the questions. That's our presentation. Thank you again for joining us from all over the country. And I'm sorry, what?
We have a couple more questions that came in.
We have a couple more questions that came in. While I was speaking, I will let Justin address those.
Sure. The first question is whether we had a sample social media policy. You know, we certainly work with our clients on a frequent basis to help them craft their social media policy. So if you have any questions and would like to follow up with us, you know, please feel free to reach out to Scott, myself, or Josh on those, and we can help you with, you know, those specific type questions. The other question that the last question we had came in was, what advice would you offer for a company that is in a state with no privacy laws? You know, I think that the biggest thing that you should be doing in those particular instances is, you know, one, you need to be aware of what the NLRB is saying about the social media policies. You know, whether or not you're in a state that has privacy laws or not, the NLRB is going to impact, their decisions are going to impact your social media policies. The second thing is, and probably the biggest thing to take into consideration, is defining your policy in such a way as to include a definition for what qualifies as a personal account versus a business account. That's going to obviate a lot of the issues that arise as to the ownership of the account, usage of the account, and it's going to start to address some of the concerns that the NLRB does have. Another thing that's really important is, and this is really to address more of the NLRB's concerns, is what do you do in it? You know, you really want to provide information about what constitutes protected confidential information, and you need to do so in such a way that it can't be interpreted as protecting or stifling protected speech. So, you know, as we talked about earlier, there, you know, one of the examples that, you know, Kroger was prohibited from doing was having, or excuse me, a company was prohibited from having in their policy was examples that might prohibit them from talking about business operations, for example, layoffs or shutdowns of plants. That would be protected speech, but you could prohibit them from, for example, sharing any document that is labeled confidential within the company publicly. That would be something that is not necessarily prohibiting protected speech. So you may want to be careful of whistleblower claims in that particular instance where it may not apply. And then finally, we received a question about how do you receive a complimentary copy of the handbook. Feel free to email one of us. Otherwise, we are taking down your names for those who have asked that question during the seminar, and we will make sure to email you a copy once that is in print. And finally, we had one last question come in, and that's how to subscribe to the blog. You want to go ahead and go to the website. It will give you an option to subscribe. And once you do, then any blog posting that we have is going to come to you directly on the day that it comes out.
Okay, everybody, that's it. We are going to sign off. Before we do, thank you again for joining us. And any further questions or comments or need any help with anything, contact us at Sci-Fi Shaw. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.